Good morning. My name is Linda Roth, and you are listening to the Hidden Prophets Teleseminar Series. This is the first in a series where we will talk about ways within companies that we can reduce cost, improve efficiency, and ultimately improve profitability. I am the founder of LJR Consulting Services. And over the last 15 years, we have helped companies unlock hidden profitability by improving efficiency, implementing new technology and business processes that help them reduce cost. Today, we are going to focus in on an overview of how to look at an organization and how to loosen what I call the profitability vice. So as I mentioned, the purpose of this series is to explore ideas of how to make your business more profitable by becoming more efficient and reducing cost. In modern businesses, we tend to focus first on revenue growth and second on financial reengineering. And over the years, we just completely overlook cost structure, except in the area of direct cost of production or, as now, during a downturn. When we do focus on cost, it's usually either just to produce just product cost or temporary budget slashing. I call this the corporate crash diet. You know what I mean. We've all been through this in our adult lives when we personally want to go on a crash diet. There's an event we want to go to or a dress or a suit we want to get into, or we all of a sudden one day get on the scale and just panic about the amount of weight that we've gained. And so then in that panic, we say, oh my gosh, we have to go on a crash diet. I have to lose X number of pounds by next week or 2 weeks or whenever it is. So we say, okay, we're just going to stop eating. I'm going to stop eating. I'm going to live on grass for the next couple of weeks, and then I'll take off a lot of weight. And so we go on that regime, and if it works, we've lost some or all of the weight that we wanted to, and we get into the dress or suit we want to get into, and we go to the event we want to go to, and then when it's all over, we breathe a big sigh of relief and say, oh, I can eat again. And so then we go back to our normal lives and eat, and over a period of time, all the weight and more is usually put back on. Well, corporations do that same thing in times like these. They say, oh, my God, we're in a recession. We're in a downturn, or perhaps our industry is in a downturn, and we've got to cut costs. So the edict comes out from executive management that we have to slash costs, and we're going to slash the marketing budget by 10%, and we're going to slash training, and we're going to freeze hiring, or we're going to lay off 10% of the workforce, or whatever things are that we think is necessary in order to do the crash spending diet. But just like our diet that we've been on to lose weight, these crash spending diets aren't changing anything. We're really just tightening the belt, and it can only last for a short period of time because we haven't changed our lifestyle. So what ends up happening is we do all this cutting, and then we find out that the cutting of the marketing budget has caused us to lose even more sales. And so then we say, oh, no, we have to go back to marketing. So then we start building up our marketing budget some more. We find out that all these people that we laid off, guess what? They weren't laying around twiddling their thumbs. They were doing something. And so that something is no longer getting done. And eventually that shows up in problems in the business. We're not able to get the reports and information we're looking for. We're not able to meet customers' expectations the way we did before. So slowly but surely, all those people come back. And they come back sometimes first in temporary workers and then eventually full-time. But either way, most of the time, we end up hiring back more people than we laid off at a higher salary than when they were originally laid off. And we have to spend money retraining people. But in the end, the situation is the same. The lifestyle of the organization has not changed, and we haven't changed the corporate lifestyle. So as a result, all of the weight or cost comes back on. there is another way to do that, to do this, and that is to change our lifestyle, take advantage of technology that's available, take advantage of services from our suppliers and service partners, and best practice business processes. And I know, everybody's sitting there saying, well, I have tons of technology. We have new systems everywhere. Well, I'm going to address that because while it's true that the majority of business today has spent an inordinate amount of money on their information technology, the reality is the return on investment on that technology spend is relatively low. And that's akin to the same thing of going to Jenny Craig or any of the other, you know, buying weight loss books and any of those other things that we do when we say we need to lose weight. Because after we've done our crash diets a couple times, then we say, oh my gosh, this isn't working. I'm going to go, you know, we hear a commercial for Jenny Craig or Weight Watchers. Or we hear about a new fad diet, you know, when the Atkins diet or the South Beach diet or whatever. Or our friends have had examples of how they have lost, you know, tons of weight and they've kept it off for 6 months or whatever. We hear about the Subway diet from Jared on TV. And so then we say, okay, well, we have to spend money now in order to do this. We can't just go on our crash diet. And that's the same thing that corporations do. They hear about, executives hear about from a conference they go to or from another executive friend of theirs, how they put in XYZ system and it did all these great things for them. So then they decide, oh, well, we're going to put in XYZ system. Or you just read general articles that you need to get more automated, and the more automated you become, the more cost that you save. And while that is true, we have to look at the ways in which we're automating. Just buying a system and putting it into our environment does not magically change anything, just like reading the diet book or joining Jenny Craig does not magically make us lose weight. There's still action that we have to take and changes we have to make as a human being in order to see the results that other people have seen. And that's usually the way that, or how it gets lost. And we as human beings, and especially a collection of human beings in a business, we don't really like change and we fight it all the way. We try to find all kinds of ways. If I just read this book, it'll make it better. If I just buy this system, it'll make it better. If I just have my IT department do things, it'll make it better, right? My IT department will do it all, and I don't have to do anything. Really, the way to invoke change is to incrementally have small change and build an environment that rewards change. And the small changes that we do don't trigger these anti-change alarms within our psyches. And it's the same way with dieting. We find that the most effective ways to diet are, okay, we pick an area, we say we're going to cut out eating certain kinds of fats, or we're going to just go on a regime where we eat all the same things we've always eaten, but in more moderation. You know, we say one of the tactics is, when you go to a restaurant, you only eat half the food or two-thirds of the food that's put on the plate, and we learn to push away part of it. And so in this seminar series, I'm going to talk about those types of strategies as it relates to corporate America. But before we get started, I'd like to talk to you about my background and how I got into this and how I've come to some of these conclusions. First of all, I graduated from high school a very long time ago, and it's when computers were just starting to be used heavily in business. It was 1970. Large companies were purchasing large computers and starting to automate transactions. And at that time in our corporate history, it was really a requirement. Companies were getting larger and larger and larger, and the volume of transactions they had to process were getting big, and they could no longer really hire enough people to complete the transactions of the business in any kind of timely manner. So in those days, there wasn't really software to buy. All the companies had to buy hardware, and then you had to have a whole bunch of people that wrote programs and that became systems. And so I became one of those legions of people, and I became a computer programmer. And that was a booming industry, and it was something that I took to naturally. I really enjoyed it. It was a great profession for me because I'm a student of business. And I sort of came by that naturally in that all the time I was growing up, my dad owned his own business, which in the 50s and 60s, that was an unusual thing. Most fathers were going to work at large companies, and my dad had his own business. And as with any small family-owned business, the key to family-owned is that the family works in it from a very young age. And so at a young age, I was put to work. First, it was as a kid. I was in sales in that I handed out flyers to people. I put flyers on people's doors. I put flyers on people's cars. I stood on street corners and handed out flyers. Then I graduated to bookkeeping. And my dad would bring home the big ledger books. And for those of you in accounting, you know, you might know what I mean. And so he brought home the big ledger books and had me enter all the AP and AR transactions and payroll transactions into the ledger books for the accountants. Then as I got a little bit older, I graduated to running the office and being in his office and taking the sales calls and taking the customer complaint calls and making sure that everything was done and coordinated. So quite truthfully, by the time I graduated from high school and went to college, I thought I was on vacation. But anyway, I enjoyed being a computer programmer, and I enjoyed figuring out how to take these business transactions and write programs that would do it. I also, though, quickly realized that I needed more than just my technology background. And so I was also fortunate enough to work for a company that had a tuition reimbursement program. So I took them up on that, and I went back to school and got my accounting degree. And that really helped me because then I could have even a better understanding of how business would run. And so fast forward a few years, and I started out and decided to build my own software consulting business. And I did that because I had implemented a whole bunch of these transaction-oriented systems, and I started realizing, mostly from the clients that I had, that management really had a thirst for more information, and they needed to get more reporting, and it was harder to do that now that all of these transactions were in systems and there was such a large volume of them. And most of these systems didn't provide that. So the software that my partners and I decided that we would develop was a software that would do that. And the big advantage to that is I got to really understand what it was that executives were looking for in terms of information on how to manage their businesses. I also started realizing as more and more companies started automating, you know, we moved into the 90s where now it wasn't just big companies that had computers. It was all company sizes to where we are today that every company has a computer, if not multiple computers. And everybody is automated at some level. But what we find is that buying systems and buying computers, just like buying diet books, joining diet programs is not a magic bullet. It doesn't automatically make things better in a company. The company buys a big fancy new system. They allocate a lot of people, time, and money to implement it. And when the new software is in and they go live, they think, presto, magically, on that day the world is better. And it really isn't, and so then there's a lot of disappointment and a lot of going back to the way things were. So that's my background, and my now goal is to help clients who have been in that environment to start seeing how they can get the ROI out and what they need to do in order to really change their corporate lifestyles. And not radically change them, but do that on a slow process so that the change sticks and everybody's involved with it. So when you change, when you put in these big computer systems, and many of you have probably experienced this, not only do things not magically get better, but it often makes it worse. First of all, employees don't know the new system as well as the old one, so they feel uncomfortable with it. And because of that, during the implementation, the team frequently turned the new system inside out in order to make it look at the look like the old system. I call this, it's like buying a new car with electric windows and then going to the driver and asking the driver, well, how'd you roll your windows up and down on the old car? And the driver says, well, I had this crank on my door and I turned it one way and the window went up and I turned it the other way and the window went down. So the implementer of the system goes off and figures out how he can take that new electric system and put a crank on it so that the user has the same user interface, a crank, so that they can crank it up and down and the window will go up and down using the crank. The challenge is this is usually making it worse because we've put some kludgy thing on the outside of the system because we can't change the whole mechanism. And then the other thing is that we have a lack of time allocated to the project to actually re-engineer the way the business functions and to use the new functions built into the new systems that we buy. Because the reality is today, every system at its core is doing the same thing. But there is a lot of the features that are in it, just like in the automobile. The core functionality of the automobile today in 2009 is not any different from the original automobile. We have an internal combustion engine. Now we do have new cars that are coming out with different technology on that, but for the most part, you got an engine, and 95% of them at least are still internal combustion engines. You've got spark plugs and everything that goes onto that. You have a braking system. You have a powertrain. You have seats and doors and lights, and it's all the same. And the whole purpose of this apparatus is to transport some number of human beings. It might, in some cars, it's as low as 2, in other cars, it's as many as 9. But transport some number of human beings from point A to point B down our highway system. But what is different about the car that was built in 1901 and the car that's built today in 2009? It has to do with the functionality around these core components that make life easier. So instead of having to go outside and crank the engine in the front of the car, we have an ignition with a key that we turn on, or in even some of the newer ones, it recognizes our finger and we don't even have to have a key anymore. As long as we have a fob, we can just push the button and the car will start. We have push-button windows instead of having a crank. We have an air conditioning system instead of what, when I was a kid, we used to call 270 air conditioning, rolling down two windows at 70 miles an hour, right? We have an air conditioning system. We have a fancy stereo. We have much more technology in the braking. We have much more technology in the construction of the automobile so it withstands crashes instead of crumbling. So the same thing is true of the systems we use in our businesses today. The early systems, their main focus was just to process core transactions like accounts receivable transactions, receiving cash payments, sending out invoices, accounts payable transactions, entering invoices, making sure that checks were cut to our vendors, pulling it all together, creating some set of basic financial statement, etc. The new systems today do all those things, and none of them do them any differently. I mean, those rules on how those are done are run by GAAP, and we have to do things a certain way. But they have a lot of other functionality around the systems that are set up to make life more efficient, but frequently we don't make use of those. So we're going to end up over this series focusing on that. So what I want to look at today is how you look at an organization to find out where your areas might be, areas of waste and inefficiently might be. And today it's just going to be an overview, and the rest of the series is we'll take each area and look at them individually. And also, I want to point out that my philosophy is that in many cases, most of these changes can be implemented with relatively small costs, if any at all. You know, a lot of it can be done just with stuff that you are already using or services that come from your suppliers and partners. And it's just a matter of taking the time, investing the time and the people to look at it and encouraging the change. So today what we are going to talk about is the profitability vice and how to assess your organization to help loosen the profitability vice. I'm going to talk, I've been talking for about 15 minutes now, but I'm going to talk until about quarter to the hour, and then I'll open up the lines for comments and questions, and that's the way we will have it for all of our meetings, so that people can get an opportunity to ask a lot of questions and talk about their individual situation. In addition to the teleseminars, you can engage in more detail with me through, number one, a webinar series that begins in June. And in that webinar series, we're going to delve into more detail as to what the solutions might be and how to implement some of those solutions. I also have corporate work groups that are starting where we'll have 4 to 6 corporations that will be represented, and we will look at your areas of improvement individually and spend time on actually putting together plans on how to implement and ideas that are unique to yourselves. And, of course, I also do one-on-one individual consulting with corporations where I go in and help them identify and help them put together teams to implement and manage those. So I'll discuss all of those more at the end of our meeting, or you can contact me individually. So let's talk about the profitability vice. A vice, any vice, has two sides that are moved closer together to tighten the grip on whatever object is being held in the vice. So in the profitability vice, corporate profits are what are being held in that vice, and today especially in our current economic environment, those profits are being squeezed by the two sides of the vice tightening. The two sides are revenue and cost. So on the revenue side, most companies today are experiencing reduced revenues in one or both forms. The revenues are eroding partly because demand is down. You know, everybody is stopped buying, or, you know, could be a short term or a long term, but buying is way down from that perspective. The other thing is companies have laid off, so some of our customers have laid off people, and that may be reducing our revenues if we are in a type of business where revenues are based on how many employees the companies that our customers have. We also see pricing pressure. If companies haven't decided to not buy your product or service, in most cases, they've come to ask you for a reduction in price, or you're just reducing price to spur greater sales. So we see pricing pressure. Also, in our world today, we constantly, even if we're not in a bad environment, or a bad economy, I mean, we constantly have new competitors coming online who are finding better ways to provide our service or product at a cheaper price point. And so we're constantly going to have to deal with the fact that there's downward pressure on prices. On the cost side of the vice, we also see a lot of situations, and we have a mix. You know, we've probably gone to a lot of our suppliers and asked for cost reductions. And maybe we're getting some of those cost reductions, but in a lot of cases, those cost reductions might be temporary. You might get, you know, a temporary break on on something that you're buying. But and we're always, as corporations, shopping around for better deals. So while as a customer, we can take advantage of some of these things, we also see some rising costs. One of the big rising costs is the cost of money in interest, and that's going to get worse, especially as the economy recovers. We all are seeing tax increases coming, and you know, the big place where all of the governments, federal, state, and city, want to hit is businesses. And so what happens when tax increases hit your business? You know, obviously, we want to try and pass that on to the customer. But in the current economic environment and the current situation, our ability to completely pass that on to the customer is going to be limited. So then that comes out of your profitability and starts squeezing the profit side of the income statement. So taxes are a big problem. And commodity prices, they're fluctuating all over the place, going up and down. But, you know, for those that there's some companies that use gold and other metals in their product or service, and we're seeing those continually to rise. Fuel costs are precipitously going up and then precipitously dropping down. They're back on their way up again. So I think we have to assume that energy prices are probably over the long run going to go up with cap and trade as a possibility, with the desire of the current administration to change and use alternative energy sources. Those alternative energy sources, all of them are more expensive, and at least in the short term. So we're probably going to see energy price increases. And as the economy recovers, some of those cost reductions that we extracted out of some of our vendors may erode, and we'll see rising prices. So I'm not suggesting that we don't shop for the best prices. I'm just suggesting that we can't rely on that alone. And also, as a part of a competitive environment and making sure that we get the best market share we can get, we also have a service component. And usually a service component means that things have to be provided to customers faster at a cheaper price. We're an impatient society, and we want products customized, we want them immediately, and we want them cheaply as we can possibly get them. So while we need to find ways to become more efficient, not only to reduce costs, we also need to find ways to become more efficient in order to better service our customers and to reach more customers. So where do we start? The first place we want to start is to assess the business or department and find the areas where we have the most pain. LJRCS, we provide assessments for businesses. And so the first place I start with an assessment is with the financial statements. Now, some of you are accountants on there, and you're used to looking at financial statements. And so our financial statements are the income statement and the balance sheet. But what we traditionally do is we just look at the format, the way things are laid out on the income statement and the balance sheet. So if we look at the balance sheet, we look at all the assets, and we look at all the liabilities. And we look month over month or year over year, and we want to ask, are our assets going up and are our liabilities going down? And we normally assume that if assets are increasing and liabilities are decreasing, that those are good things. And I'm going to talk about ways that those aren't necessarily always good things, especially assets increasing. The other thing we look at is the income statement. And we generally go straight to the bottom line and say, okay, what's our net income? And if net income is within what we projected it to be, and if it is getting better, we consider life is good. We also look at revenue, and we want to see that revenue is getting better. And we assume that if revenue is getting better, then life is good. And those are the big areas we look at. We, you know, every company has certain cost areas that they look at to make sure that those cost areas increases are within line. And so that's generally the end all of the financial statements. There might be a few ratios we look at, like if you're in retail, you're going to look at sales per square foot. You might look at, or same store sales year over year, things like that. But there's a lot of information in the financial statements that we don't really look at. The first one is cash flow. And what we really want to know is cash flow negative or positive. There are many, many, many companies today that have that are profitable organizations that have a positive profit at the end of the income statement, but their cash flow is either completely negative or does not cover their cash outflow sufficiently. And so when you have a negative cash flow, you are building debt, and debt is costly because the only way you can make that up is you have to borrow money. And that has always been costly, and it's getting more and more costly. So what are some of the key reasons for negative cash flow? One that I find consistently is poor billing and receivables management. So some of the ratios that you can find on your financial statements on those is what is your average days that your receivable are outstanding? What is the average time after your product or service has been rendered or fulfilled in order to create an invoice? What is the accuracy of the invoices that are created? Another is poor payables management, not taking discounts, the vendor terms, not using banking options that you have today for cash management, credit cards, the use of credit cards in a company. Along with poor payables management comes poor purchasing processes. Now that's not really going to show up too much on the income statement or on the financial statements, primarily because poor purchasing management means that we don't even show a liability in purchasing until it becomes a payable. So the financial statements are looking primarily, what you'll see is poor payables management. And things to look at is how much discount is taken versus what's available to you, how many days are your average payment terms. Those are the primary ratios you'll see on financial statements. Inventory buildup. Inventory buildup is a big one in companies because that takes a lot of cash. Now, on inventory buildup, on the financial statements, it looks like we're just swapping one asset for another. But the reality is, frequently, an inventory asset is not worth as much as the cash asset that it was swapped for, especially over time. Over time, inventory loses value. So the ratios you want to look at on your financial statements are inventory turnover. How high is that? Or really, the problem is, how low is it? You know, I have seen clients where inventory turn is barely one time a year, and that's a problem. You also want to look, if you can, at inventory turns by product categories, because you could have a good average, but you have some product categories that they're just sitting there, and they have a less than one inventory turn, but you have other inventory categories that are turning rapidly. So that's the biggest one on inventory, and then, of course, just looking at year over year, what the size of your inventory is. But that could be good or bad depending on how fast the company's growing. So it's really inventory turnover. Another area on your financial statement is depreciation. Capitalization of expenditures often hides problems, because the cash is used up immediately, but the expense is allocated over a period of time. Now, of course, you know, I mean, in our current accounting process, there are certain rules on capitalization, and, you know, we're certainly going to capitalize certain things. But what I have seen in a lot of clients, you know, we're going to capitalize asset purchases because we want to match the cost of the asset over the life of the asset. But what I have found in a lot of companies is that, first of all, we justify buying things, even if they're assets, that may not necessarily be needed because they can be capitalized. We also capitalize things that, while legally we can get away with capitalizing them and it helps our profitability, we ought to really look at the cash impact that the capitalization of that expenditure has. And and know what we're doing to our cash at the time that we do that, and whether that is offset by the other opportunity cost of the cash or the interest cost that we're going to have for carrying that expenditure and using that cash when we don't have it. The most effective assessment process that I use, I mean, you get a lot of information off of the financial statements, places to look at, but the really big one is just using our eyes and observing what's going on and in areas. And so some of the places to look, I just call this, you know, walking around. But you want to look at the flow of information and transactions and the organization. So some key areas that I take a look at when I'm doing an assessment is how are invoices produced. I find a whole lot of companies where this is an extraordinarily manual process. And what you'll find is that they have a point in time where they can produce an invoice, and we're usually producing invoices when we can recognize revenue. So that could be on shipment of a product. It could be a billable milestone on a construction or some other type engineering or consulting project. It could be at the end of the month when you know, like we do service billings. I have one client that is a parking management company. So at the end of the month, they provide invoices to every one of their customers for what was previously done. And so what you find, especially in service businesses, it's an extraordinarily manual process to produce an invoice. And you have this balance between trying to get an invoice out in a good time and having it accurate. So you have two problems. First of all, invoices either take a long time to get out, and so then you're holding up cash from that, or you send them out and there's an accuracy problem. And so then from the accuracy problem, you have one of two issues that come up. Either the customer won't pay because they know the invoice isn't accurate and they have some questions and you've got to spend a whole lot of time going back and researching and fixing it before the customer pays it, or B, the customer pays it, and then because that's the way the invoice was presented and the customer paid it, the customer no longer has a liability to you. And so you lose money that you accurately earned because of poor invoicing. So that's an area to look at. Excuse me. How do you produce invoices? And then once you produce the invoice, how is the invoice recognized? And what is your process for recognizing cash payments and applying those to invoices correctly? And most importantly, what is your process for tracking collections? Too often in companies, the process for tracking collections is just a whenever you get around to it, or when a salesman is looking at a particular customer's account and realizes that this customer hasn't paid in 90 days or the balance for this customer is way high and we got to call up this customer and get it, or we need cash and so then we need to go through and find the customers that haven't paid and start banging on their doors. That's not a good collections management process. Another way is purchasing. How are purchases approved and the liabilities tracked? I find in companies today that lack of using an automated purchasing system is epidemic. And so that gives way to overspending. Overspending in a couple of ways. One is you're spending too much for products that you actually need. You're buying from a vendor that's not an approved vendor. You may have a contract with a vendor, but people out in the field don't know that's where they have to buy from, so they go out and buy from a local vendor and pay more for it. Buying things that aren't necessary. Use of credit cards in a company. It's a lack of purchasing control with the use of credit cards. And I've had clients where they have just these big surprise purchases. And I'm not talking about small things in terms of, you know, going out to restaurants or travel expenses. I'm talking about companies that end up with $20,000 expenditures on credit cards that nobody in management knew about. inventory purchases. How's demand determined for inventory? So many companies today don't have a good way, a good accurate way of tracking demand, and so the whole process then becomes, well, we just purchase enough to make sure that we're never out of it, and that tends toward the inventory buildup. So do you know what the lead times are from your vendors? How do you plan for customer demand? We'll look at these things in future teleseminars. Expediting. How much money is spent on expediting shipments either from suppliers or to customers because of poor planning? So things you want to look at is how much are the costs, you know, what are your costs in Federal Express bills and other expediting methods that you can look on your financial statements and see where those are and try to find out how often you're expediting things just because it was poor planning on your process, on your side. Consolidated versus distributed departments. How many AR, AP, payroll, accounting, customer service departments does your company have? Many companies today have grown by acquisition or, you know, they've just sprawled out and started growing by opening up new offices. And so they open up a new office or they buy another company and they keep the AR department, the AP department, payroll. And so we end up with now fairly good-sized companies that have not one, not two, but, you know, a dozen or more of these departments that leads to inefficiency and more people than you need to have if you have a consolidated department. And when we talk about this in detail, we'll talk about the pros and cons of consolidated versus distributed departments. Manual approvals and manual processes. How much time is wasted in your company tracking paper or even email documents? People tell me, oh, well, we don't track paper. We email everything. But the only thing that email does is make it faster for it to get to point A to point B. But things sit in people's email inboxes just like they sit in their paper inboxes and don't get addressed. So how much time is spent in tracking all that stuff that then causes a lack of planning and a crisis at the end when it finally gets approved, so you pay more or you have to spend money on expediting things. Standardization. How many companies say that they're entrepreneurial or they've just grown by acquisition and so there's no standard process? And we all know that companies like McDonald's and Walmart, which are known for their standardization, are the most profitable and most envied companies. So how can we become to where more things are standardized? How many systems are being used in your company? How many ERP systems do you have? How many AR and AP systems? How many CRM systems? The bigger the proliferation of systems, the more ineffective you are. How integrated are your systems? So, you know, is the sales system integrated with AR? Manufacturing integrated with accounting, fixed assets and outside systems, are they integrated with your GL? Wherever there is a lack of automated integration between two systems, you have manual processes that have been built up, and thus they're taking people and they're inefficient. Some examples of that, I've had customers where invoicing is done on Excel spreadsheets or Word documents out in the field. That invoice is then sent out to the customer. It may or may not have an invoice number on it. Then that invoice is emailed or paper mailed into corporate accounting, and corporate accounting re-enters that invoice into the AR system. So there you have duplicate processes and inefficiency. Then when the customer pays the invoice, then it's this whole big event of trying to figure out what invoice the customer paid because the invoice numbers are different. So things like that are causing a lot of inefficiency in environments. The same way with purchasing. If you don't have an automated purchasing system and the requirement for AP to pay a bill is they've got to have a receiver, they've got to get a hold of a manual piece of paper, and so now you're tracking that paper and trying to track the receipt before you go ahead and make the payment. So that's not integrated. Outside systems like outside payroll, fixed asset systems, those things that aren't integrated with general ledger, how many of you have large accounting departments that spend all their time manually doing these journal entries in order to post these systems or post this information into your GL when they can be automated and just by a simple upgrade usually. The use of Excel spreadsheets. Excel is a great tool, but it's been way overused in corporate America and too often takes the place of automated processes. Everybody says, well, I use a computer, I use Excel. But Excel is really a manual process that's doing, it's an automated calculator. It's doing the calculations for you, but it's not a computerized system. And so again, some of the examples I used are manually doing journal entries, manually doing allocations, within spreadsheets, manually doing invoicing within spreadsheets, manually doing management reports within spreadsheets because you have all these different systems. So again, that creates a large group of people that are manually, usually accounting people, that are manually doing all of this. So anyway, these are the type of things. So in the weeks to come, we're going to address all of these areas individually, and I'm going to talk about ways to look at how you can improve these and solutions, both technology and process-wise, that can be brought to these areas and improve them so that you can get a reduction in cost. So for the next 2 weeks, your homework is, what I'd like you to do is look around your organization and see if you've got any of these pockets that we've talked about. I think just like people who do an assessment before they go on a diet, and you know, lots of times the rule that people like Jenny Craig and all those give you is for a week, don't change anything you do, but just write down everything that you eat, everything that you consume, and people suddenly start realizing, oh my gosh, I'm drinking, you know, 5 Cokes a day. And I look at the can, and those 5 Cokes a day have got an average of 120 or 150 calories per Coke, right, or whatever drink it is that's your favorite. Or monitoring how much, you know, when you really start looking and you say, I'm eating just one serving, but that one serving, you know, is a 12-ounce steak when on the dietary rules it's 2 ounces of protein, not 12 ounces. And what's the difference in the caloric intake of 12 ounces versus 2 ounces? So I want you guys to do the same thing over the next couple of weeks, and that is look at your organizations and just write down some of your observations. Start counting how many systems you have, how many people are doing certain processes. And then as we talk about it in the weeks to come, we can start seeing ideas where that can change. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and unmute the lines. I've gone a little bit long today, but I am going to unmute the lines and see if we have any questions from people. Okay, is anybody still with us today?
I am. This is Betty. I'm still on. I don't have any questions.
Okay. What were your thoughts?
It's probably better to address it at another time.
Okay. All right. Feel free to call me anytime that you would like. I'll give out my contact information. You can email me at You can email me at Linda, L-Y-N-D-A, dot Roth, R-O-T-H, at ljrconsultingservices.com.
Okay.
Okay. I also have, you might know, Betty, I have a shorter email address. It's Linda at ljrcs.com, but there's a very strict spam filter on that one, so you have to reply to a message when you email that one. So the other one is open. And also my phone number is 818-709-6583. So, Betty, I hope you join us next week. And also, please feel free to send out these invitations to all your friends and clients. And for everyone signed up, you will get an automatic invitation to the next one, which I think on the letter it said that it was May 21st, and that's been changed to May 28th. So our next teleseminar will be May 28th at 10 a.m.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you, Linda.
Uh-huh. Bye.